Hello, everyone. I'm your host, Andrea Weckerly, and welcome to the Ready Living Podcast, where each episode is designed to educate, inspire, and empower you to create the life you want. Thanks for joining us, and remember to subscribe for free on your favorite platform. My guest today is Daniel J. Solove, one of the world's leading experts in privacy law. He is the Eugene L. and Barbara A. Bernard Professor of Intellectual Property and Technology Law at the George Washington University Law School and the author of over 10 books and more than 100 articles. His work has been cited in thousands of publications, excerpted in numerous casebooks, and discussed in many judicial opinions, including those by the U.S. Supreme Court, federal courts of appeal, district courts, and state supreme courts. He is the number one most cited law professor born after 1970 and the number one most cited law professor in the law and technology field. He's lectured at universities, companies, and government agencies around the world. A graduate of Yale Law School, he is also the founder of Teach Privacy, a privacy and cybersecurity training company offering the largest and most specialized courses and materials on privacy. Welcome, Dan.
Thanks for having me.
Your new book titled On Privacy and Technology, which is coming out in March of 2025, is really amazing. I had the pleasure of reading an early copy. It's a detailed discussion on how technology is impacting privacy, why we should be concerned, and boy, should we be concerned, and what we can do about it. Yet you make it clear that technology isn't the enemy and say that if there is a villain in the story, it's the law's role as well as certain ways of thinking about technology, privacy, and the law. When we talk about privacy, everyone usually nods their head, but in fact, people often aren't in agreement about what it means. In a 2024 article published on SSRN titled Against Privacy Essentialism, you talk about the challenge of trying to define privacy and say, what is privacy? This is a question that has long been vexing, but it is of profound importance as the way privacy is conceptualized influences the outcome of cases and the way that laws and regulations are crafted, interpreted, and enforced. How privacy is understood thus makes a difference about how it is protected and what is included and excluded from an understanding of privacy often affects whether it is even protected at all. You argue against privacy essentialism, meaning the idea that privacy has clear and fixed boundaries because it merely provides the illusion of certainty and clarity. You also say that it often leads to law and policy that ignores important privacy problems and neglects serious privacy harms because they do not really fit within the narrow boundaries of a particular conception of privacy. Privacy law and policy are better developed with a taxonomic approach, which is more inclusive, flexible, and evolving than the essentialist approach. For people who are not legal experts, can you explain what that means in simple terms?
One thing I always emphasize to my students when I'm teaching them privacy law is that anytime there's a privacy statute or a case or even a company that says, we love privacy, we protect privacy, or we design for privacy, there's always a conception of privacy that's involved. There's always a vision of what privacy encompasses, what it protects and doesn't protect. And oftentimes this is unstated. So a court will say, oh, okay, that's not private. That's not part of a reasonable expectation of privacy. Or a legislature will pass a law saying this is a privacy law, but it will cover some things and not cover other things. And I think it's really important that we look at that because a lot of times there are things that are not covered or times where courts will say, hey, that's not private or there's no expectation of privacy here when I strongly disagree. And I think that a lot of people would strongly disagree because it's a different understanding of privacy. And for a long time, a lot of the attempts to try to conceptualize privacy, to try to understand what exactly is it. We need clear boundaries and a clear common denominator to say this is privacy and this is not. I think the problem with this is that we saw this for decades and decades of scholars and articles written about this. They all ended up being either too broad or too narrow. Some of them were so broad, it was privacy is the right to be let alone, but that could be anything. But a lot of the definitions are too narrow. They exclude a lot of things, and that's a problem. Because if something is excluded from privacy, if it's not seen as private, then it's not protected. And that, to me, is a big problem because we need protection for everything. And ultimately, privacy, I argued in my work for a very long time, is many different things. It's many different problems that are related. They have differences, but they have similarity. We say, okay, there are similarities. We can learn from the similarities, and the solutions might also be related or might work together. But we also should pay attention to the differences too. Rather than trying to jam everything into some pre-established conception of privacy that often winds up being too narrow and then leaving out everything.
You said that privacy is a protection against certain forms of societal impingement on individuals that affect their personal life. And in your new book, you mentioned 4 general categories and 16 subcategories of activities that can lead to disruption of a person's private life. The 4 general categories are information collection, meaning the methods by which data about people are collected, information processing, the storage, use, and analysis of personal data, information dissemination, the ways in which personal data is transferred or disclosed, and invasions, meaning the direct interference with a person's life. And in a 2022 Boston University Law Review article you co-authored with University of Virginia School of Law Professor Danielle Keats Citrone, aptly titled Privacy Harms, you listed a typology of privacy harms that range from physical, economic, reputational, psychological, autonomy, and discrimination harms. Can you give us a couple of examples of what these harms can look like concretely and the impact they have on people in their daily lives?
Yeah. So there's actually a lot of different ways that a privacy violation can create harm. When does a privacy violation cause some kind of an injury or something damaging to people or society? And that's an important question because when should the law intervene to try to make someone whole or fix the problem, prevent the harm? So we need to look at what the nature of these harms are. Harms can range from economic harm. You know, if your identity is stolen, you could have economic harm. It can range from reputational damage. You know, someone reveals private information about someone and it hurts them reputationally. But it also can be emotional distress. Something might not harm somebody reputationally, but they just might not want people to know about it. Or it might be embarrassing, but not necessarily job destroying. We talk about things like autonomy harms, that it's a disrespect for your autonomy. It might not be an embarrassing fact, but it might not be a fact that people want others to know. So someone might have cancer. They might not be embarrassed by it, but they might not want that to be known by others. They might not want it to be part of a conversation with others. They might not want to be talking about their health with others. And so they might not want that to be shared. But it might not cost them any money. It might not hurt them, you know, in terms of reputation. It might not lead to a job loss. It could, but it might not. But I think there's still a harm. And the harm there is autonomy harms. You know, people, you know, should have some control over how they share information with others and the kinds of aspects of their life that others should know about. There are a lot of different types of harms with privacy beyond the traditional ones. The law is very good about recognizing economic harm or physical harm, and it's pretty good at recognizing reputational harm. But then the law really starts to struggle when it comes to emotional distress, anxiety, disrespect for somebody's desires and autonomy. That's where the law really starts to waver and the cases get kind of all garbled up and courts don't recognize these harms in a lot of cases. And so the point of our article was to say, actually, you know, we need to do a better job about this because in other contexts, the courts are getting, they do recognize these harms, but it does happen. And this is a theme in my new book, that whenever something involves technology, all of a sudden it's like the law and judges and everything else gets like a brain freeze. They forget every other area of law and suddenly just kind of throw up their hands and think, oh my gosh, we don't know what to do. We can't recognize any harm or whatever. What I call kind of technology exceptionalism, where technology is treated in a way differently than everything else. And if the law were to just treat these things like it does other things, we'd have a much, much better world and a much better law, and people would be much better protected.
I've heard you say we can't abstain from technology, meaning digital technology, and that we shouldn't since it helps us in so many ways. But for years now, you've been ringing the warning bell about technology's impact on privacy. And one of the problems, you argue, is how we collectively, and especially the law, tends to look at privacy as an individual interest rather than a societal interest. And this becomes an issue when privacy clashes with other interests we've deemed to be important from a social perspective, such as free speech, security, innovation, efficiency, and transparency. Is the clash between privacy and other societal values a uniquely American issue, or is it a challenge faced by other countries as well?
Definitely worldwide. Privacy is really a global issue. There are more than 160 countries that have a comprehensive privacy law. The most well-known privacy law around the world, the most influential one, is the one in the EU, which governs all the EU member nations, the General Data Protection Regulation, or GDPR. The US lacks a comprehensive privacy law. So we have a bunch of different federal privacy laws, at least 20 or 30 of them, that regulate in different industries. They all do it differently. They all protect differently. They use different terminology. They cover different things. So it's a kind of weird patchwork mess. And then on top of that, we have a lot of state laws that also are regulating privacy as well. So the U.S. approach is kind of all over the place. It's incredibly messy. But what we see is that when we look across the U.S. and across the world, we definitely see that there is a lot of concern about privacy. It is a major legislative concern. A lot of laws are being passed. I don't think the laws are working very well, but there's certainly a lot of interest and concern that have generated a lot of attention in legislation and regulation for this issue.
Design frames how people make decisions about their privacy, and you've even said that control the design, control the decision. What exactly do you mean by that?
One of the things with technology is that so much about how it works and how it impacts the data that people share and the uses of data that people agree to, just generally, you know, how people interact and use with the technology is how the technology is designed. The interface of the technology, like what you see, the choices that are presented to a user in technology, the way ways that the technology will try to nudge people to do things, or sometimes force people to do things, or make it hard for people to do things, or easier for people to do things. All this is about design. So that's why I say, you know, control the design, control the decision. If you design something in some ways, you know, people will act in ways that are expected. So you want people to share data, you can design things to make people share more data or not share more data. And social media works this way. You know, these algorithms are built to try to design and structure how people speak and interact on social media. And they encourage certain things and discourage other things. You know, they want people to stay in the platform and they want people to be as engaged as possible in the platform. Encourage more polarized speech and more extreme speech. And they'll try to amp that up because that helps them keep these people in the platform. God forbid they actually do something other than use the platform. But all this is designed. For a very long time, regulators have been very afraid to touch design. They don't want to regulate it because they're concerned about, you know, not being deferential to the tech companies. Like, well, we don't know much about technology. It's too complicated for us. Who are we to tell them how to build their technologies? So we should be hands off. We shouldn't do design. The problem with it is that design is really key. You can't be hands off with design. You can't just give them a pass to design their technologies. Regulating design does not mean actually going in and like writing code for the companies. It doesn't mean nitpicking every little thing they do. It does mean making certain mandates about goals that should be designed for and designed against. One interesting story with design is that, you know, even though it was long the thing that regulators were afraid of touching, a very interesting development happened where someone coined the term dark patterns to talk about designs that were manipulative, that manipulated people into doing things they didn't want to do. And all of a sudden, privacy laws started to regulate dark patterns. patterns. And it's much, much easier for a policymaker to say, yeah, we don't like dark patterns. It sounds awful. It sounds bad. So we can regulate that. But we don't want to regulate design. The thing is that dark patterns are design. It is about design. It's just a different term for design that regulators felt a little more comfortable with. And I think that law has to look at design and has to say, don't manipulate. Set the defaults that are privacy protected rather than not. Make it easy for people to change their privacy preferences rather than making it really hard and complicated. So there are things that can be mandated that don't micromanage companies, but still set forth the boundaries on what's good and not good in design.
One of the things I hear constantly, and which you take issue with as well, is the retort whenever anybody mentions privacy, namely that as long as a person doesn't have anything to hide, they shouldn't care about privacy. You call this the nothing to hide argument. Why do you consider this a flawed argument?
It has a particular conception of privacy. And that conception of privacy is a very individualistic conception, and it's also a very narrow conception. And so when someone says, shouldn't care about privacy because I have nothing to hide. Well, first of all, it's very individualistic. It's very, selfish. It's important for society that people who want to hide certain things and don't want to disclose it have the right to do so. The other thing is it views privacy as being only about hiding things. Privacy is the ability to, have some control over the information that's shared about you. Well, suppose I'm doing research online and I'm researching terrorism or I'm researching poison or I'm researching bombs and now I'm nervous. Well, what if I'm a writer? I'm writing for a TV show. I want to learn about bombs. I want to do research and I really don't have anything to hide. So basically now I have to worry though about what is some bureaucrat in the FBI or the NSA who might be surveilling me, what are they going to think when they see these searches? Am I going to get on some list? That's not a free society. That's not a society we want to live in. Generally, the view is we should be able to do what we want, free of worrying about like what some bureaucrat who doesn't know us is going to be thinking when they're looking over our shoulder. So it's not about hiding things. It's about something very, very different. It's about freedom.
Presumably, you're looking up all sorts of wild things as well, Dan, right?
I used to teach criminal law, and there's a case where these kids tried to poison their teacher with rat poison. During class, I'll kind of joke and I'll say, okay, let's say, you do a search online.
Oh, great.
For, how much rat poison does it take to kill a person? So I'll type it in, but I'm afraid to if I hit enter, then it goes into the Google search history and why is he searching for that? Well, I'm actually just trying to do something humorous to teach a class. And so that's the biggest concern. If we have the government watching over us all the time and our data being gathered like this, the context gets lost. And then we have to constantly explain things, to the government. Do I have to tell them every search and what my search history is going to be? And then it becomes not innocent before being proven guilty or, you're free until you do something wrong. And you've always got to somehow answer to the government. That's the problem. It's, people should be able to search for what they search and not have to worry about someone at the NSA is going to be thinking.
That's what you're talking about is the long-term societal impact of hidden surveillance, really creating a society where we aren't free despite perhaps thinking we are. But there are all these things that government entities, whether they're at the state or federal level, are doing in terms of the data that we are using and producing to draw conclusions that might not be accurate.
Exactly. I think that's a very big problem. Certainly the government needs to enforce the law and to engage in surveillance to keep people safe. But there are costs to it and there are dangers, especially when the government, in the times we're living in now, we're living in times where risks and dangers of authoritarianism, we're living in a world where states are increasingly trying to find data about people who are traveling out of state for abortions or who are trying to seek gender-affirming care and other things. So they're doing these techniques that are prying into people's lives to get data. And one of the things that historically, authoritarian regimes have done is they've used data and technology to put people under surveillance and to use that to identify people who were disfavored, who had views that they didn't like, ultimately rounding up people and doing just terrible things. this is the danger that I think we need to guard against. Governments now have such a treasure trove of data that they can tap into. They have this unprecedented surveillance technology that is incredibly sophisticated. They have AI that can analyze the surveillance data that's been gathered to an unprecedented degree and make it much more efficient. And they also have this access to this immense amount of data from every facet of our lives, from how we surf the internet to all the different apps we're using to location data. And this data then can be analyzed by sophisticated AI algorithms to make inferences that reveal even more information about people. And so they want to find out, is someone pregnant? They don't need to actually go and get some doctor's record about that. They can actually infer that by looking at relatively innocuous, mundane data. The big story about 14 years ago, Target, they were able to look at people's purchases and determine if they were pregnant. This was early on. So it wasn't purchases about baby products. This was purchases about non-baby stuff so they could figure out if they were pregnant before they started buying the baby products. And the algorithm was able to do this with a pretty good degree of accuracy. And the things that people bought that kind of gave them away, that it figured out the patterns, were unscented products, cotton balls. They're not thinking, okay, when I go to the store and I buy an unscented lotion and I buy a cotton balls, that now suddenly I've given away my health information. But that's what can be done now. And so these inferences can be made. And when you have so much data about people being gathered, and then such sophisticated algorithms that are looking for patterns and data across millions of people, sometimes billions of people, this is an unprecedented world of surveillance and government power. Just imagine what the world would have been like, what would have happened last century if the Nazis had the technology of today.
I think that brings the point home viscerally for a lot of people. And I do want to talk about social media briefly, because on social media, people feel that they are free to have open and direct conversations with others. But as you've pointed out, platforms' algorithms often shape conversations by what they amplify and promote. X, formerly known as Twitter, is a perfect example of this. As you said, the platform is known to amplify emotional content, especially content that expresses anger. In other words, platforms like X enhance polarization, which in turn gives people the impression that the public's views are more divisive and extreme than they actually are. Why does this matter? There are people who argue that we shouldn't care what a bunch of people who are angry or upset online do.
It affects real life. The platforms don't just reflect the world, but they shape the world. If people are constantly exposed to these extreme views on social media, a lot of people, that's where they get their news. And so if they think, oh my gosh, everyone's furious and outraged, it shapes the debate. And what we see now is this explosion of misinformation. A weather person has to worry about, their safety, because if they report the weather, or people say stuff about health, they're attacked. It's not reflective of everyone. It sounds louder in the echo chamber. But people become madder because they hear these things that make them mad, but they're often fueled with misinformation and stoked to drive people to these greater extremes. I think it's wrong to think like people's views are somehow fixed. They're highly malleable and they're highly suggestible. And so, if you amplify up the polarization, you amplify up the extremism, people are going to be more extreme. If you play it down, let's be calm, let's look at the facts, it shifts the other direction. Unfortunately, there are a lot of folks that benefit from the extreme, that want to exploit the extreme dialogue, that want to create more division, that want to make the United States look like it's highly divided and everyone's hating each other. And they want that because that gives them power. And the platform, some of them want to do that because it enhances the particular views of their founders who have views on things that they want to promote, or it lines their pocket with profit. But ultimately, it, I think, damages society. I think it leads to tremendous social costs and really hurts. It really hurts and damages this country and the world by what they're doing.
In your book, you talk about several myths that stand in the way of the law properly addressing problems involving technology and privacy. And I want to talk about three of them here, namely the myth of the privacy paradox, the myth that regulation stifles innovation, and the myth of technology neutrality. Let's start with the myth of the privacy paradox. We often hear tech leaders claim that people don't really care about privacy all that much because they willingly share things online, especially on social media, and don't engage enough in privacy self-management, such as reading privacy notices, opting out of certain uses of their data, accessing and correcting their records, and requesting their data to be deleted. Why do you argue that this is truly a myth?
This is a myth because I think people really do care, but I think that the actions that people are doing are not really reflective of their attitude. They're more reflective of the crappy choices people are given, the meaninglessness of a lot of the privacy tasks that people are given, the chores that people are given to do with their privacy that ultimately are not scalable and not doable. It's hard to read one privacy notice, let alone thousands of privacy notices. They're incredibly long, and they keep getting longer and longer and longer. One estimate was it took hundreds of hours a year to read through privacy notices. And that's an old study. It's a study from 15, 20 years ago. It's probably more like doubled or tripled now. The onus shouldn't be on people to do this. And the fact that people don't do all these chores doesn't mean they don't care about privacy. Because a lot of times companies and the legislatures will say, look, we gave people all these rights. Look, we gave you the right to access your data. We gave you the right to correct your data. We gave you the right to delete your data. So, goodbye. Look, if you want to protect your privacy, here are these things. Just go and do it if you care. But otherwise, let companies do whatever the heck they want. That's not protecting privacy. The fact that people don't use their rights does not mean they are not concerned about privacy or that things shouldn't be done to protect them. And it's all a fiction, right? We know people don't read it. Everyone knows that. Every study shows that people don't read it. And, companies could, if they wanted, right, they could actually measure whether or not someone read it. They could track, how long people spend at the page. You could say, okay, look, it takes about 30 to 40 minutes to read all this junk. So why don't we black out the site or gray out the site so that people can't access the site for 30 minutes to make sure that they read it, and then we'll let them access the site. Of course, we'd say, oh my gosh, the internet would totally grind to a halt. It wouldn't work, right? But then we go through the fiction, somehow people read this. We know no one's reading this junk. And even if you read the stuff, because I've read the stuff, it's not helpful. It doesn't answer the key questions. What's the key question I think people really want to know? What benefits am I going to get if I share my data or use this service or use this app? What cool stuff am I going to get? What's it going to do for me? And then what are the risks? How could I be harmed? And that's what you want to be able to do, make a risk calculation. But I don't think you really can do that. And the privacy notices don't help you. If they say, oh yeah, we love your privacy. We care about your privacy. Okay, how are you using the data? Tell me all the different uses. Let me go back and forth. How good is your training? I want to see your vendor agreements. How good is your security? Just telling me you have reasonable security doesn't help me. I want to know what kind of encryption are you using and how are you encrypting and when are you encrypting and what are your access controls like? Do you do pen testing? Do you do this? Do you do that? The policies don't go into that. We're creating a system that's all a fiction, all just a big lie. We're asking people to do things that they just can't do and they shouldn't be doing.
The myth that regulation stifles innovation argues that regulation stifles innovation and burdens organizations with unnecessary regulation and associated costs. You featured a fun cartoon on Teach Privacy that talks about what it would look like if foxes were regulated like privacy is regulated in the United States. There is a sign that says, "Fox Law, state how many hens you want to eat, then eat only that amount." One fox says to the other, "This law is outrageous and burdensome," while the second fox responds, "Yeah, it's stifling my ability to innovate." I mean, this really drives the point home beautifully. And so I wonder, why is the notion that innovation and regulation stand in opposite to each other false? What would you say to that?
Well, anytime you regulate this or anytime you hold us responsible and accountable, we can't innovate. And I think this is total BS. I have another cartoon where I have a Star Wars theme and I have one theme, tech companies, and has Darth Vader saying, "I'm all powerful, I can do anything." And then the other frame has also tech companies and it has Luke and Yoda. And it's when Luke is being trained by Yoda and Luke is kind of whining. It's like, I can't do it. It's too hard. It's basically Yoda's asking him, can you just follow, you know, regulation and be responsible? And that's what we get from tech companies. They're very quick to tout like how they can innovate to do all sorts of things. It's like, hey, no problem we can't solve. We can take you to Mars. No worries. Our AI can do everything. It can solve your life, improve the world, and do anything. But then you ask them, hey, will you like be responsible and figure out how to eliminate harms that your data causes? And they say, oh my gosh, we can't do it. Why can't you innovate to make something safer, make something better, comply with the law better? You know, so really what they're saying with this innovation is they're really saying, like, just don't regulate us, just trust us, don't hold us accountable. We don't want to innovate to make things safe and be accountable. We only want to innovate when it's profitable for us. But if you force them to innovate, to make something safer, they can. So, you know, we said to the car manufacturers, hey, you know, why don't you innovate for safety? Why don't you come up with airbags and seatbelts? And we're going to make you do these things. There are innovations that could help technology. Just imagine if all the engineers, instead of focusing on, like, how do we create this data extraction tool to get your data and deliver more ads to you or make more money, and let's put some of them on how do we make our product safer? How do we make this better and less harmful to individuals or society? That kind of innovation could be great. I think they really could innovate that way, but they're not going to do it because the incentives aren't there. Unless the law tells them, you must do this, we're going to force you to do it, they're not going to do it. That's why the law needs to force them. Too often, policymakers get enthralled by this argument, I can't innovate. If we don't do it, then our other countries are going to do it. So you can't regulate us. I think all this is bogus. You got to set the right incentive. And that's a key theme in my book. Basic economics works. And at basic economics, one of the first things that you learn in economics, one of the key principles in economics is, you know, incentives work. And so if the incentive is you can make a ton of money and be totally irresponsible, they're going to do it. The only way you're going to get them to act responsibly is to make sure that there are incentives to act responsibly. Right now, the incentives are all you get more ahead. If you move fast and you break things, that's how you get ahead. Because we've set the incentives for them to do it. And then they do it. And then everyone's like, oh my gosh, I can't believe, like, why are they doing it? And we just somehow hope that companies are going to be restrained. But I say in the book, like, it's kind of like asking a shark to be a vegetarian. And the sharks are like, yeah, oh yeah, just self-regulation. We'll be good. And they're sharks. And that's what companies are structured to do. They're designed to make a profit. I don't think they're evil. I think they're doing exactly what they're built to do. It's on the law to rein them in. Stop buying these silly arguments and actually, you know, policymakers, do your job. Like, how many times have we heard self-regulation throughout history? It's never worked ever.
You mentioned another myth, which is the myth of technology neutrality. Can you tell us in what ways technology is in fact not neutral?
Yeah. So the myth is, like, a lot of folks will say, we should delegate more decisions to technology, to AI algorithms, because they're not biased like humans. You know, the computers, they just use math. They're going to be fairer and more just and not prejudiced. The problem is that that's not true. And technology is really never neutral. The bias comes in through the data. And so a lot of times there are a lot of uses of what are called algorithmic predictions. They're used to determine sentencing of convicted offenders. You know, how long should we sentence them for? Are they likely to commit a crime in the future? And these algorithms make a prediction about that. The algorithms are being used to determine, you know, students who are at risk of dropping out of high school. They're used to determine hiring of people, who's likely to be a good employee. And the problem is that the data that these algorithms are trained on is infected with human bias. So yeah, the algorithms are all math, but the data is biased data, reflects society's bias. So one point, Amazon.com said, hey, we want to use this algorithm to hire people because it's going to help us eliminate bias. It wound up only recommending males. Well, they trained it on the data of the employees that they currently had, but those employees were systematically, hired to be more male. It learned the bias. And what's dangerous when the algorithms incorporate the bias is that they magnify it, they perpetuate it, they systematize it. At least with humans making the decision, there is going to be the chance that a human will break the cycle, will say, hey, I'm not going to be biased. I'm not going to do this. The algorithm is ruthless. So we have to be very careful, because to see technology as neutral is to fail to see what it is. It's never neutral. It's not neutral. We need to be very cautious. We need to start questioning everything.
I want to share another one of your Teach Privacy cartoons, because it talks about AI. One colleague talks to another about their office robot. And the first person says, what's wrong with our robot? He's a total asshole. He constantly hurls insults, has crazy extreme views, makes threats, and most of what he says is false. I don't understand why our AI is so bad. And then the colleague responds, well, we did train him from data on social media. So I love these cartoons. I think they're really brilliant. How do you come up with them?
I usually just kind of try to think of something that's kind of like a witty way of saying something true. And then they just come to me. They're funny because the problems are sometimes so obvious. And sometimes it's so ridiculous, the arguments that I'll see used, the assumptions that people make that I think are funny. When you really look at them, you see, oh, wow, like just how foolish this is, how foolish self-regulation is. So I want the cartoon to show just how absurd it is. Because actually, that's how a lot of U.S. law works. If we go back to the Fox cartoon, there is law, but it's largely a law that is not that far away from self-regulation. The law just says, as long as you say what you want to do in the privacy notice, then we're only going to make sure that you held to your promise. So it still gives companies a lot of leeway. So that's what happened with AI. When AI took off, a lot of companies quickly changed their privacy notices to say, now we will use your data to train our AI. So, now we can use it. It's not asking much of them at all. It's not providing much protection at all.
You talked about big data companies collecting personal data. What they basically do is collect a bunch of publicly available information and then create dossiers about individuals. Before I get to my question, I do want to share one last Teach Privacy cartoon, which talks about all the data that companies have about a person. And it shows a call center operator speaking into a headset and telling a customer, you have a choice about how we use your data. Do you want us to use your data in creepy ways, very creepy ways, or extremely creepy ways? When I saw that, I laughed because that's exactly how I feel about all of this data collection. What kind of data do these dossiers contain, and what is the data used for?
The data in the dossiers is incredibly extensive. There are companies that can monitor every click, every twitch, how long you linger. They can measure every little thing. Everything you do is measured. Everything you charge is recorded. Everywhere you go, there's location data for where you go. How you surf the internet, everything you buy, everywhere you walk, surveillance cameras, and so on. The dossiers are how you piece this data together. Companies then share the data with each other. So they'll share it with each other, they'll share it with the government. And this is how you build these extensive dossiers that have a lot of information. And then on top of that, you have the algorithms that are analyzing the data. So now you can take all this data and you can analyze it and learn more data. That's the target story. They had all the purchases that someone bought, but then from those purchases, you can make all sorts of inferences about things. And they just chose pregnancy, but you can say, hey, I can, if I want to find out, like, what are someone's political beliefs from their purchases? Well, now today, everything is politicized. I mean, you can't even buy a pillow these days. Pillows are politics. For goodness sakes, I want to go back to the world where I could just sleep on a pillow. Does my chicken have to have politics? Does my pillow have to have politics? But now everything you buy, like where you go, where you shop, what you buy, all can give away your political beliefs. Where you live is going to give away information about your race. It could give information about your religion. Same thing with data, right? You can look at, okay, what products are you buying? buying? Well, based on the products that you buy, you can make inferences about people's religion and all sorts of beliefs that they may have. That also goes into the dossiers, is the second order data derived from the data that's collected. And then the uses are incredibly broad for all sorts of things. Things that are, okay, let's decide what ads people see online to, you know, insurance getting the data. The government could analyze this data to decide different things about you, whether or not you get a loan or not, or a license, or hired or not, or anything. That's the internet experience these days, where like every little thing you do is being tracked and monitored. So it really is like you're in this kind of glass cage where everyone's watching you.
One of the laws that has hugely shaped the modern internet experience in the United States is the Communications Decency Act of 1996, specifically Section 230. In your book, you argue that it facilitates the spread of reputation-harming data. Can you explain how it does this and whether you believe an overhaul of CDA is needed and what that should look like?
CDA 230 was a law that was designed originally to encourage platforms to moderate bad stuff. It was responding to a case where a platform bulletin board tried to tout that it was family friendly and it would try to remove obscene material. And the court said, well, that means you're responsible for anything anyone posts on it. And so 230 basically was a law that said a platform should not be responsible or treated as the speaker when the content is posted by somebody else. So, you know, if somebody else posts something on X, you post something on X, X isn't the speaker of that. They shouldn't be treated as the speaker and shouldn't be liable as if they said it. Courts decided on their own to rewrite the law. They totally twisted the law. And then they said that anytime any content is on a social media site, you're immune. There was long something called distributor liability, which said that even if you're not the speaker, if you know or have reason to know that something is defamatory, invasive of privacy, then it's a different story because now you're not innocent. But now if you're on notice, if you actually know it's bad, different story. But courts said no. In fact, 230 immunizes with that. It's not the case anymore where it's just a bulletin board and you just post. These sites now have very intrusive algorithms that are shaping the conversation. They're trying to promote more extreme things. They're trying to keep you on the platform. They decide what things you see and what order that you see them. Ironically, I would rewrite 230 exactly for what it says. And then I would just say, let's interpret it as it is written and stop twisting it to anything else. The basic premise, I think, is right. If I'm a big platform and someone posts something on my platform, I shouldn't be responsible for that content, at least initially, because, you know, there's millions of people posting millions of things. But there's a difference when I know that it's harmful. Now I should have responsibilities. That's different. If I'm doing things that encourage the posting of bad stuff, now I'm not in, like, I'm not just some innocent platform and someone comes along and posts something. I've actually solicited this content. Please come in and go and post this gossip about people, post nude pictures about people without their consent. And we're going to help you. We encourage you to do this. Encouraging, you should be liable for that because you're shaping the speech. And the same thing with the algorithms. If the algorithms are shaping things, they should be responsible for what their algorithms are doing.
In the modern age, it's virtually impossible to not have an online presence. One of the really interesting things in your book is the discussion about reasonable expectation of privacy. And you say that the reasonable expectation of privacy test is flawed because it focuses on expectations rather than desires.
The reasonable expectation of privacy test is used primarily in Fourth Amendment law, and that regulates government surveillance and what police can do when they search. And the operable test for what the search is there a reasonable expectation of privacy in something? Problem with that is the Supreme Court and lower courts really don't actually look at what privacy people actually expect. They just decide themselves. They say, oh, people don't expect this or people expect this. How do they know? They don't have some like unique ability without empirical evidence. the problem with expectations of privacy is, well, they are shaped by the lack of privacy or all the privacy problems and concerns out there. A lot of times we want the law to intervene when people don't expect privacy, but want privacy or think that privacy would be important and better to have in a situation. I think it's wrong to say, okay, the law should only provide protection against government surveillance when people expect privacy. And even beyond that, I think that the Fourth Amendment is often too narrowly limited to privacy. And one of the problems then is that it turns on what the conceptions of privacy are by the courts. The Supreme Court has a pretty narrow conception of privacy, so it's excluding a lot of things, which I think is unfortunate. The real question should be, when do we want protection or accountability or some kind of limitation, oversight of government surveillance? The key is, if there's a problem and we think that oversight, accountability, limitation, et cetera, would be useful here, let's do it. For a long time, the court says, well, when a third party has your data, you don't have an expectation of privacy. Today, like, all our data is in the hands of third parties. Everything you do on the internet, a third party has. You know, everything you buy, a third party has data about it. Literally everything. So essentially, the Fourth Amendment doesn't apply to massive amounts of data, all the digital dossiers about people, no Fourth Amendment protection because of this third party doctrine. I think that's a big problem. That's exactly where we need oversight of what the government's doing. And that's what happens. When the Fourth Amendment doesn't apply, you don't get protection. It means the government can just do what it wants to do without any oversight whatsoever.
Your book talks about the need for the law to step up and take action to protect privacy, but also notes that to date, at least here in the United States, the law has largely failed to do that. What legal framework, and you've been touching on this throughout our talk today, but what legal framework is needed to create such accountability, and what practical steps must we take to make that happen, especially now in our current political climate? And I want to add to that, you recently wrote an op-ed in the Boston Globe titled States Can Fight Authoritarianism by Shoring Up Privacy Laws.
Ultimately, I don't think there's like one silver bullet, one magic answer to this. You know, the book is a very short book. My goal is to try to talk very generally about, you know, how to think about these issues and then some recipes of different directions the law can go in. But I don't really go and start writing out specific laws. But I do think that there are certain general principles for the laws we should think about. Design laws that are principle-based rather than tethered to very specific technology. The law regulating electronic surveillance is a law that dates back to 1986. Year after year, there are calls for Congress to update that law. Congress cannot tie its shoes. Congress cannot change a light bulb. Congress really is a completely dysfunctional body. This law was passed in the days when barely anyone used email. It doesn't make sense today. And so we see a lot of cases where, you know, courts struggle, like, how do we apply this law that was written so closely to technology circa 1986? That's just one example. There's so many other laws that are so old and they really don't make sense today. We have all these surveillance cameras and all this access to data, and there's no framework there. How long can the data be kept? What can we do to analyze it? How do we make sure the government's not abusing it? There's nothing. It's kind of like a kid. You know, do you just say, here, play with this like dangerous electrical toy. You can do whatever the hell you want with it. Here it is. Or the alternative is, no, you can play with the toy, but we're going to make sure that you can't abuse it. And it's going to be safe. The op-ed that I wrote was, look, we had years and decades to address these problems. And now we're taking this authoritarian turn. We don't know where it's going to go, how bad it's going to get, but our law is not ready for it. The status quo is really bad. When are we going to get the wake up? It's like climate change. When are people going to wake up? It's often going to be too late. Maybe for a change, it would be really good if we acted a little early before we have the next, you know, Nazi regime. The same thing with AI. It seems that history keeps repeating itself in this regard.
Meta founder Mark Zuckerberg just announced that Meta will pivot to a community notes model that uses crowdsourced fact-checking contributions from users. And additionally, it said that it plans to allow more speech by lifting some restrictions on some topics that are part of mainstream discussions. When I first heard this, my reaction was, what could possibly go wrong? What are your thoughts on Meta's announcement?
I think it's disappointing. There were certainly problems with the existing content moderation. It's hard to do. The timing of it definitely looks like pandering. The way that it was expressed and rolled out was also very disappointing. It seemed like kind of capitulating to a vision of what the current administration would be happy with. So it doesn't mean that the existing system didn't have flaws or couldn't have been improved upon, but I certainly do not think the current direction is a particularly good, productive, good faith effort to rethink this whole thing.
Where can people go to learn more about you and your work?
My website, danielsolov.com, is the best place. That has information about my scholarship, most of my papers, a number of my older books I posted on SSRN for free, the electronic version. My newest book comes out in March of this year. And for that, you can just pick up a copy on Amazon. You can go right now and pre-order a copy. You can also get a copy from Oxford University Press website. And if you're interested in my cartoons that we've talked about, you can go to my website, teachprivacy.com. That's where I have the stuff I do for my training company. And there's a newsletter that you can sign up with. And then you'll never miss a cartoon. And it's free. It gives you the latest of what I'm coming out with and what I'm writing about.
Definitely sign up because you want to get your hands on those cartoons. They always make me laugh. So Dan, thank you so very much for having taken the time today.
Thanks so much for having me.